From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley, filling in for Terry Gross. The critically acclaimed TV show Friday Night Lights, about high school football in a small Texas town, has been given the go-ahead for a third season. Many of its fans are breathing a sigh of relief. On today's Fresh Air, we meet Kyle Chandler, the actor who plays the passionate but flawed coach, Eric Taylor. Also, confused about which is the safest fish to eat? We get some tips from Tim Fitzgerald with the Environmental Defense Fund Group. They have a new fish buying guide. Book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews a new book about four Teach for America recruits in their first year at an inner-city high school. And jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the new recording by the Chris Byers Quartet. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, TV critic for Broadcasting and Cable Magazine and TVWorthWatching.com, in for Terry Gross. Friday Night Lights, the critically acclaimed NBC adaptation of the book and movie about a Texas high school football coach and his family, recently was renewed for a third season. Its second season comes out on DVD this week. Our guest today is Kyle Chandler, the star of Friday Night Lights. He plays Coach Eric Taylor, the no-nonsense father figure to a bunch of wayward gridiron guys in a small Texas town. And his concept of no-nonsense is exactly that.
Listen up. Got Westby in 2 days. I know y'all don't want another loss pinned on your asses. Quarterbacks and receivers are going to be with me today. Linemen on the boards with Mac. Any questions?
No, sir.
What's that?
No, sir.
I didn't hear you.
No, sir.
All right, let's go. Let's have some fun today.
Let's get out there.
Chandler appeared in the recent remake of King Kong, but his most identifiable roles have been on television. He played the World War II heartthrob in Homefront, a man who tries to change the future in Early Edition, and, most recently and memorably, the ill-fated bomb expert on Grey's Anatomy. The movie version of Friday Night Lights was directed by Peter Berg, who's also executive producer of the TV series. I asked Kyle Chandler what advice Berg gave the actors when they started shooting the pilot.
He told us, he said, look, know your dialogue when you come to the set. You've got to know your characters. If you don't know your characters, if you haven't created them, it's not going to work. You've got to know your characters 110%. And he said, the last thing is get ready to throw all the dialogue away. We might just throw it away and do new stuff. So right then, it's exciting. Mm-hmm. I mean, some actors freeze, some directors, when they come, they freeze. But if you're ready for that and you want to just expand, it's the perfect fertile ground.
Now, your biggest fellow actress is Connie Britton, who plays your wife, Tammy, who came from the movie. So she already was familiar with both the character and maybe Peter's style of work. How did you guys bond initially? How did you get to a level field? Did she help you out? Did you not need the help?
I didn't need the help, and she didn't have to do anything. As soon as we met, it was clear that the casting was perfect. Initially, we shook hands, said hello, and within 10 seconds, we're already starting to barb on each other. We both have a very similar sense of timing and comedy, and we both love comedy. And, you know, there's not much of that in the show, but there's enough of it to create that relationship. And we realized one day that I can play the fool in front of Connie, and there's no problems. And she can always play the fool in front of me, and there's no problems. And the reason there's no problem is because on the show, when we do play the fool for each other, as actors, we never let the other one hit the ground. We always catch them right before they do. And it's very similar to a marriage. I've been married 12 years, and that's it. That, you know, no matter how angry we get with each other, no matter how hard we fight, it's okay, because we know that we're always going to be together. I mean, that's the bottom line.
I'd like to play a scene that I think exemplifies this and shows some of the humor. It's from the first season of the show. You've had a problem with an air conditioning unit, and you meet with your wife in a diner, and she seems to have come up with a solution that you may or may not like.
You go first.
Okay. You want the good news or the bad news?
No, good news. Always the good news.
All right, I'll give you the bad news. AC, done. Like I said, we need a new unit, $3,000 minimum.
What's the good news? Our cold front moving in?
No, the good news is that I think I might be able to help you pay for the new unit, because I think I got myself a job.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
That fast
mm-hmm.
you got a job?
Yeah.
Where'd you get the job?
At the school.
What school?
At the high school.
What? At my high school?
I wasn't aware that you had bought it, but yeah, I'm the new guidance counselor at the high school.
You know, guidance counselors can be a nuisance, and that means
Eric,
that we're going to have some interaction.
Well, that's good. I like that we're going to have interaction. I think that's great that we're going to have some interaction.
Well, I just think that we should probably talk about it.
Well, I've taken the job already.
Well, gee, what happened to the consultation we were going to have? Hello, Coach Taylor.
One of the things about the role, one of the directions in which you go sometimes, is you're not afraid to be a jerk. which is very endearing, and for a TV heroic lead, fairly unusual. How much fun is that to play?
It's the greatest thrill in the world. I mean, even when I did Early Edition years ago, the fellow who gets the newspaper, a cat brings you a newspaper.
Yeah.
You know, at the beginning of that show, though, seriously, I was basically directed in the area of being the hero, being the man who goes out and saves the day. And I had big problems with that even as a young actor. I knew it was wrong. And I knew immediately, this guy hates cats, because it wasn't written that way. And I knew another thing, this guy does not want this responsibility. And that worked. It worked for 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
And on this role, no one's perfect. No one's. I'd be lying if I was going to get on screen and be this perfect guy. I love falling. I love playing a role where I think I'm right, and then you learn you're not. And it's what you do with that information.
Right.
What do you do with it when you realize you're wrong? How do you say, I'm wrong, or I'm sorry, or this and that? And I don't want to make it too easy on them, but it's great to be wrong. It's great to be a jerk and then realize I was wrong. It's real life. I mean, it's fun. It's a joy to play.
There's one other clip that I want to play, and it's from the championship game episode from the first season. And here you are playing the coach, coming in and talking to your team, but your team is down at halftime, and you're confronting the team.
When Jason Street went down the first game of the season, everybody wrote us off. Everybody.
And yet here we are at the championship game. 40,000 people out there have also written us off. There are a few out there who do still believe in you. Few'll never give up on you. You go back out on the field, those are the people I want in your minds. Those are the people I want in your hearts.
Every man at some point in his life is going to lose a battle. He's going to fight and he's going to lose. But what makes him a man is that in the midst of that battle, he does not lose himself. This game is not over. This battle is not over.
So let's hear it one more time. Together. Clear eyes, full hearts. Let's go!
Your reaction?
Well, I've got chills, to be quite honest. That quiet speech followed by those kids in there with, can't lose. It's the perfect setup for the scene. We were up in Dallas shooting that, and I had the flu. I was sick as a dog. I remember Pete Berg coming down on the field to say hello to me, and he just walked away because everyone knew. So I do remember doing that scene. It was a daze. I was in a daze, actually. But right before that clip went on, I was thinking the one thing that allows me to do so much on this show is honesty. And this is a very honest show. There's a reality to it that comes out of me quite easily. I think that's what makes that scene, because out of my honesty, those kids have the honesty, and they're sharing it right back with me.
In terms of your acting career, I guess other than Friday Night Lights, the thing for which you're most famous in the last few years anyway, was your appearance in a two-parter on Grey's Anatomy where you played a bomb expert that was brought in to rescue the character of Meredith.
Yeah.
I understand that led to you being cast in Friday Night Lights. I'm not sure whether it's because the casting director for both shows are the same or because Peter Berg was floating around there, who was one of the executive producers. Do you have a story about that before I play a fast clip and ask you a question about that?
Yeah, I do. First of all, I want to say when I went to do that, I was very, very nervous. And it was outside the door of the studio that I stopped and literally closed my eyes and talked to myself and said, listen, you can go in here and you can be nervous and you can do it that way, or you can get yourself together and realize you can go in here and do a great job and get your mindset. And I literally forced my mind to go to the ladder and it was great, enjoyable. I left my fears at the door. That alone was a great accomplishment for that whole experience.
Let's play a clip from Grey's Anatomy, and this is your character who is exuding a lot of confidence in taking Meredith down a hospital hallway as she has her hand inside a patient, and she's holding an explosive device that if she lets go of it, chances are the whole hospital is gone. So let's play.
You're doing great.
Let's go over it again.
The device is shaped like a rocket. About 8 inches long. We're going to have everything ready. Dr. Burke's team is going to be in place. My team is going to be in place. And I'm going to ask you to take the hand that you have in Mr. Carlson. Wrap it around the device.
And pull it out.
Level. Pull it out while keeping it level.
You know I don't like you very much.
I don't like you either.
What memories do you have of shooting that or the impact of that role?
Well, I don't know. First of all, I have to say seeing it is one thing with the dialogue, with the visuals, but without the visuals, that sounded rather risque, I must say. Holy cow. that was a really interesting experience doing that show because, you know, I think it was right during the Emmy season when I was working on it. So, you know, you've got this show that's so popular. It's the Emmy show, and you've got all these actors that are entrenched in their roles on the show, so you really have to carve out your own niche. I think it's the first, since like China Beach or something, it was the very first guest starring role I'd done within 10 or 12 years. I mean, that's a whole other job coming on guest starring on a show.
Mm-hmm.
I realized that real quick. But as well, those people not only work hard, long hours over there, but, you know, they're working in a hospital. And after a few days, I felt I was in a hospital. I actually poured one cup of coffee I had down a water fountain drain on the set. And it fell on my feet because it's just a hollow tube underneath. I thought it was a water fountain. You get to think you're living in a hospital. So, you know, I think the crew takes on a complete different sense of humor, I think, because they work in a hospital every day.
We're talking with Kyle Chandler, star of the NBC series Friday Night Lights. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Our guest is Kyle Chandler, who plays Coach Eric Taylor on NBC's Friday Night Lights. For a television star of one of the best shows on TV right now, you're kind of an enigma. I mean, you've starred in other TV shows and you've starred in movies, but we don't know as much about you as we do about a lot of people who are at this level. So your father, according to the biographical material I've been able to read, was one of the things that he did was he was a farm owner and your mother was a dog breeder. this sounds like no matter where you went as a kid, you were hit with chores. Is that true?
When we moved down to Georgia, we owned 22 acres of land. About 7 of it was pasture. We had we went from Lake Forest, Illinois, which is not a farming community by a long stretch. And my father, He bought this piece of land. They'd always raised and showed, they showed Great Danes. They've always had Great Danes. They were very successful with the breeding and the showing of them. Hence, I was always in a motorhome traveling around the country going to these dog shows as a kid. as well, down there, we had a boarding kennel. So the responsibility of 22 acres with a boarding kennel, a business, and there were a lot of chores, a lot of responsibilities, and I did the best I could to keep up with them, yes.
What about your own high school experience rings true to you, even though it's a different generation? What do you remember? I know you played high school football for a couple of years and you've downplayed your abilities, but what do you remember about the other players and the coaches and just the other students in general?
Mm. Uh, high school was interesting because I went from a public school, middle school, to an academy where the first year we were doing Latin, chemistry, biology. I was woefully unprepared for the type of study. At any rate, it was halfway through that first year of school as well that my father passed away. However, he did get to see that year. I played football for the very first time. I was the smallest fella on the team.
Mm-hmm.
And we won the state championship. So I've got to experience something that very few people get to experience. I didn't play. I was rather small and very heavy. However, I put my 2 cents in worth, and the joy of winning that state championship, I felt just as much of my sweat was on the field as mm-hmm. anyone else's. And it was just an incredible feeling of accomplishment, and it was a proud moment. And the things that I learned out on that football field, again, lessons that you just don't forget. You know, the guy who reaches down and picks you up and says, "Hey, good job," even though he's 6'2" and just knocked your helmet off your head. It makes you feel good. You learn lessons about yourself. You learn about yourself, what you can give and how far you can go. High school itself was just like any other high school. I was lost. I wasn't one of the cool people. I wasn't, you know, I always felt more comfortable being the quiet outsider, especially after my father died. And that seclusion and that quietness, I think, might be the reason I do what I do and I understand a little bit better what I do.
If this is too sensitive a question, just tell me. But I'm wondering if at that age, when you lose a parent, if you have to make a conscious decision to decide how to act to the people around you, to your friends, to the people who don't know you, to your relatives, and if that isn't some sort of the most horrific kind of acting choice.
I would go a step further and say that you try to figure out how to act with people so many different times in so many different ways that in the end you're not quite sure how you're acting, but that's the choice. Do you know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
That I can remember now thinking about it, trying to figure out how to act, how to be. Because not only do you lose a parent, and it's such a shock, I was in a new world for not very long before I lost him. I'm 14 at this point, 14 years old, a boy loses his father. It, you know, there are worse things in the world by far, but it's complicated.
Mm-hmm.
And I never knew how to be a man. I didn't have a figure to bounce off of. My mother, a wonderful woman, just can't take the place of that. My brothers and my sister were moved on. So I was always trying to figure out how to act, how to be. And I was always very conscious. It made me very, very self-conscious. And I was also far more introspective, and I was far more curious about observing others and how they did it.
We're talking with Kyle Chandler, who plays Coach Eric Taylor on NBC's Friday Night Lights. You talked early, when your dad died when you were a kid, about not really knowing, you know, how to be a father, or at least what a father was providing for those years. And then here you are on a television show where your relationship with your TV daughter is so important, and you're a father figure to so many kids on the team. And I'm wondering how you learned that, how you approached that. And then now that you have, daughters who are 11 and 5, how that's fed your real life.
Look, I am a father, and there's no way, no one gives you a book on how to be a father. I've learned that. I remember my coach from high school, and I remember many coaches, and I've been down there and I've met many coaches, and they are figures of extreme importance and authority. Once I, Kyle, strap on that Southern accent and I'm a coach out there and I'm dealing with kids who I'm responsible for, one of the coaches I met literally when I was studying the role, I was holding his baby in my arms, and we were barbecuing. They allowed me to come over to their house, and he gave me the biggest hook into this whole role I have. And he said, "Look, no one's going to coach. No one's going to be a good coach. No one wants to coach, except for one reason: because you love the kids." And that was a complete lock for me. I mean, I'm in. Mm-hmm. You love the kids. So there I am. Now I get to play with, yeah, you love the kids, but what's more important when it comes down to it? Is it winning or the kids? Because if you don't win, your family's going to get kicked out of town. So you've got all these dilemmas that come up. There's so much to this role that I'm playing. It's so much. I can go anywhere with it. I've lived a little bit of it, and I sense a little bit of it, and I practice with a little bit and step out and see what happens with it.
All right. Well, Kyle Chandler, thanks very much for being on Fresh Air.
It was a pleasure to be here. I love your show, and thank you so much.
Kyle Chandler, star of the NBC series Friday Night Lights. The DVD box set of the show's second season comes out tomorrow, and the third season will premiere in the fall on DirecTV, then be shown on NBC. I'm David Biancooley, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from the Pew Charitable Trusts, driven by the power of knowledge to solve today's most challenging problems at pewtrusts.org. From Bantam Trade Paperbacks, publisher of Extraordinary Knowing About Skepticism, Science, and the Powers of the Human Mind by Dr. Elizabeth Lloyd Mayer. And from the Overbrook Foundation, supporting Catalog Choice, a service that allows customers to decide which catalogs to receive in the mail at catalogchoice.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
That's music by the Chris Byers Quartet. Coming up, Kevin Whitehead reviews their new CD. Also, concerned about mercury in your fish? We get some tips on which is the safest fish to buy from Tim Fitzgerald of the Environmental Defense Fund Group. And Maureen Corrigan reviews a new book about four Teach for America recruits in an inner-city high school. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Biancooley, in for Terry Gross. Books about the classroom experience, like Goodbye, Mr. Chips, To Sir With Love, and Up the Down Staircase, grab our attention because we've all sat in a classroom at some point in our lives, and because teaching stories always revolve around the theme of transformation. Book critic Maureen Corrigan has just read another good teaching tale, this one nonfiction, about the Teach for America program and its core of young, idealistic recruits. The book is called Relentless Pursuit, and it's written by former Newsweek correspondent Donna Foote. Here's Maureen's review.
There's a goofy and endearing, but also telling classroom moment that Donna Foote describes towards the end of her new book about four Teach for America recruits and their first year at an inner-city high school in Los Angeles. One of the recruits, a 22-year-old Boston College grad turned biology teacher, whose name is Hrog Hamalian, is doing a PowerPoint presentation on sickle cells when he stops for a minute, looks around, and realizes that every student in the classroom is staring at him, listening. The idea that all these teenagers are looking to him as the authority figure, a guy who just last year was a party-hardy college senior, is such a mind blow that Hrog bursts out laughing. The kids, taken aback, stare harder, which only makes Hrog laugh harder, so hard he can't catch his breath. Eventually, Hrog gets the giddies under control, and the lesson proceeds. Foote presents this particular moment as something of a triumph. During his first semester teaching at Locke High School, Hrog was so stressed out he couldn't sleep. By spring, he's on top of things, and more importantly, test scores show that his kids are learning. But Hrog's laughter also exposes a bleaker social absurdity, one that Foote probes throughout her smart book. For all his ferocious hard work and talent for teaching, Hrog is just 22. Like the other young recruits, he was plopped into his classroom after only 5 weeks of summer boot camp run by the Teach for America program. Depending on what chapter of Foote's book you happen to be reading, the sections describing the masochistic idealism of the Teach for America recruits, or the other, more sobering sections detailing how an infantry of Teach for America neophytes is all that's keeping some of America's neediest public schools functioning, well, you could, like Hrog, laugh or cry. Foote's book is called Relentless Pursuit, and it's a substantive and unromantic account, not only of a year in the collective lives of those four new recruits at Locke High School, but also of the Teach for America program, founded in 1990 by Wendy Kopp, a Princeton undergrad who wrote her senior thesis on the idea of starting a national teacher corps, like the Peace Corps. As Foote describes, Kopp matched her visionary dreams to a shrewd realization. She recognized that to make the low-paying profession of teaching attractive to the me generation, there had to be an aura of status and selectivity about Teach for America. Fast forward to 2005, the year Hrog and his colleagues enter the program. To attain the privilege of teaching at Locke, a gang-ridden, barbed-wire bedlam in the heart of Watts, the four recruits had to beat out nearly 20,000 other new college grads from the nation's most elite institutions for the 2,000 teaching slots offered by Teach for America. Lucky them, the cynical reader thinks. But the amazing thing is that this gang of four does come to believe that they're mostly lucky to be teaching at Locke. The kids in Taylor Rifkin's ninth grade English class, for instance, start out the year chattering and fighting through her lectures. They end it doing grade-level analysis of Romeo and Juliet. And the transformations occur in both directions. By the end of the year, all four of the recruits are hooked on education as a career and have come to identify so much with their students that they find themselves no longer able to entertain friends and relatives with ghetto teaching battle stories. It feels like a betrayal to tell those tales out of school, although fortunately, for the sake of dramatic interest, Donna Foote has no such qualms. As I often do, I have a graduating senior in one of my classes right now who's entering the Teach for America program. I told him about Foote's book and how, after reading it, I was even more filled with admiration for what he was doing. I sounded like every doddering parent, mentor, or donor that Foote describes in her book. And like every Teach for America recruit who Foote describes, my student, the overachieving, humble type the program seeks, just shrugged off my praise.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Relentless Pursuit, A Year in the Trenches with Teach for America by Donna Foote. Coming up, a conversation about which fish to eat and avoid with marine scientist Tim Fitzgerald. This is Fresh Air. Like many people, I'm eating a lot more seafood these days and feeling a little proud of myself for eating healthier. But what if I shouldn't feel so proud? What if the fish I've been grilling is fast becoming endangered? And what if the sushi I love to order is so high in mercury, more than a few pieces a week, actually is dangerous to my health? To answer these questions, I spoke with Tim Fitzgerald, a marine scientist who works in the Oceans Project at the Environmental Defense Fund. The EDF is a nonprofit, nonpartisan environmental advocacy group that provides scientific information about what's happening to the planet and the creatures that inhabit it. For Fitzgerald, this means touring the globe to study various species of fish and shellfish, which types are being overfished or poorly farmed, which ones are healthy to eat, and which ones pose a serious health risk. Keeping all that straight isn't easy, but Fitzgerald and the EDF have made it simpler. By creating an easy-to-read, easier-to-carry wallet card, listing the latest news about what to order and avoid the next time you visit the seafood counter at the supermarket or go to your favorite restaurant. Well, let me ask you just one or two questions about this seafood selector. On some of the worst lists are things that for years I've thought I've been a very good person by ordering and eating. You know, Chilean sea bass, red snapper, bluefin tuna, imported caviar. They're all in the worst, and they're fairly popular choices. Can you explain with one or two of those what makes them the worst in terms of the conditions that Environmental Defense has examined?
Sure. You know, in many, maybe not all, but in a lot of these cases, these fish are being loved to death, and that they're so popular and they're so widespread and the demand for them is so high that that's really driving a lot of the negative environmental issues with each one. For example, overfishing is probably the most common environmental issue that most people associate with their seafood. You mentioned caviar, Chilean sea bass, red snapper, things like that. These are all fish that have been historically fished at a rate that was higher than would allow their populations to recover.
Well, doesn't that become sort of a catch-22 of catching fish? I mean, by putting something on the best list and you're telling people this is the stuff you should go after, you're in danger of endangering it just by leading to higher demand?
In a lot of cases, especially with the wild fish on the best choices list, one of the reasons that they're on the best choices list is that they have a very responsible and cautious management regime. So, for example, wild Alaskan salmon is on the best choices list and is a very popular and abundant fishery in Alaska. Demand for wild Alaskan salmon is very high right now and will probably continue to rise in the coming years. But one of the reasons we consider wild Alaskan salmon so highly is that the management structure is such that it's almost impossible for very severe overfishing to occur. There's lots of controls that basically shut the system down if not enough fish return to their spawning streams or if there's just too much fishing pressure.
In doing some research for this, I got really depressed about some of the global things that you have to contend with after you identify the problems. Just to use an example, that if there are Europeans that are overfishing bluefin tuna in the Mediterranean, there are scientists there that recommend quota levels, and then the European Union officials double those quotas, and then fishermen routinely exceed those quotas by half, and that's just one example with one fish.
Well, unfortunately, you hit on probably one of the most extreme yet telling examples of how fisheries management can go terribly wrong. Bluefin tuna is possibly one of the most valuable fish in the world. You know, it's so prized in the sushi market, especially in Japan, that it really drives some pretty extraordinary fishing levels. Single fish have gone for over $100,000 at auction, so you can imagine what kind of financial incentive there is to catch that fish. It's also a fish that doesn't really obey national boundaries. You know, there's nothing to keep it from swimming through European waters into African waters or North American waters, et cetera. And traditionally, those are fish that are very hard to manage because they require international treaties. And when you have that kind of fishing pressure going on in multiple places for the same fish, you can imagine their populations are pretty hammered right now.
There's a new book called Bottom Feeder by Taras Gresko, if I'm pronouncing that name correctly, The subtitle is How to Eat Ethically in a World of Vanishing Seafood. So I thought it was fair game. And one thing in there really creeped me out. According to Gresko, tilapia and tuna. Now, I don't know whether this is U.S. tilapia or Latin America tilapia or Asian tilapia, but somewhere tilapia and tuna are being treated with carbon monoxide, also known as tasteless smoke, to prevent the meat from turning brown and to keep it that nice, healthy-looking red almost forever. Is that widespread, and isn't that just wrong?
It's definitely very widespread in tuna. I'm not I was not aware of it being used in tilapia. But for tuna, you know, everyone wants that really deep red, almost purplish color in their tuna, you know, almost like a beefsteak. But tuna, after it's caught and once it's processed, starts to slowly turn, you know, shades of brown. And that is not necessarily an indication of bad quality. It's just the flesh starting to oxidize. But when fish are mishandled, a lot of times that will speed up the browning process, if you will, and you'll see bruises or brown spots, et cetera. And this carbon monoxide or tasteless smoke is a gas that basically reverses that process. But just from a color standpoint, it really just turns the fish back to that bright shade of red. And so it's really used to basically cover up mishandling and possibly even fish that's maybe a little bit past its prime.
And if this is a really naive question, but shouldn't there be some federal regulation that keeps that from happening?
Well, there are a lot of unfortunately, there are a lot of these consumer right to know things that there doesn't really exist good regulation for. Another example, very similar, is the orange coloring in farmed salmon. In the wild, you know, salmon are eating a whole bunch of things, and some of them are krill, which, you know, have shells that have this red or orange pigment in their shells. And so the salmon eat the krill, and they absorb the color from the krill, which is how they get their very distinct orange color. But in farm salmon, they're eating formulated pelleted feed, which is made from a combination of ground-up fish and soy protein and minerals and those kinds of things. And so they have to put a synthetic version of that pigment into the feed. Otherwise, the farm salmon would be kind of a grayish color. And so in some places, it's actually required by law that you label farm salmon as color added.
And then I have questions about one fish that I see and don't know what it is, and another fish that I don't see and wonder where it is. What is a Hawaiian butterfish?
A Hawaiian butterfish? Well, as you've probably noticed in many seafood markets, names are not always consistent. And a lot of times you can pretty much call a fish not anything you want, but there's a lot of leeway in the regulatory system for fish names. A Hawaiian butterfish can be a number of things. The most common is probably something called escalar, which is a pretty interesting-looking fish. It's also sold in sushi restaurants under the name white tuna. And from what I've read, in about 50% of the people that eat it, they have a negative intestinal reaction to it.
Ah. And
yeah.
And I may have this wrong, but wasn't Chilean sea bass once called something a lot less attractive than Chilean sea bass?
A Chilean sea bass is actually just one of these made-up market names to make the fish sound more appetizing and probably sell it for more money. The more kind of common name is Patagonian toothfish.
Gee, why would you ever change that? And so the one that I don't see anymore that I used to catch when I was growing up in South Florida, kingfish, is that still out there or is that called something else?
It's definitely available. Again, it's one of these fish that goes by four or five different names. You said you were catching it in Florida.
Mm-hmm.
Probably king mackerel. It's definitely still around. It's actually a very well-managed fishery. It's just it's not something that you see a lot in the commercial markets, you know, outside of where it's caught. Yeah, it's a very popular recreational fish.
Would it be on your okay, worst, or best list?
It's not on our seafood card just for the reason that it's not a very large market share.
Mm-hmm.
We do have more information about it on our website. But another thing to point out with that specific fish is that it tends to be very high in mercury. So it is actually on the FDA advisory list for mercury levels.
What are the dangers of farmed salmon? I understand that there are times where they can get caught in nets and then they get parasites and they get diseases and there are all sorts of side effects that aren't supposed to be there and aren't very beneficial to the whole fish farming system.
Unfortunately, there are a number of environmental issues with salmon farming. It's probably one of the poster species for, you know, how not to farm fish. They're grown in what we call net cages or net pens, which are just, you know, kind of floating enclosures in nearshore waters. And a lot of times they grow them at very high densities. And just like with chicken or pigs or any other animal, when you grow them in very close proximity to one another, a lot of times they'll get stressed. When they get stressed, they're more susceptible to disease or parasites. When they get diseases or parasites, they often have to be treated with chemicals or antibiotics. So unfortunately, you have this kind of negative feedback cycle where one problem begets another. And there's also issues with harassing or even killing predators. A lot of times there will be seals or sea lions that, you know, are just trying to get a free meal. They see this floating pen full of dinner and they just, you know, want to get a little bit. And a lot of times farmers will either install these acoustic harassment devices, which are pingers that drive the animals away, or sometimes they'll even just shoot them. So those are just some of the issues with salmon farming. They also create a lot of waste, which doesn't get treated. It just goes directly into the environment, given that it's a floating cage. So a lot of pretty serious environmental issues with salmon farming.
What fish would you steer us towards that we might not have ever tried before that we ought to try?
Well, a lot of the fish that are on our best choices list are some of the smaller, oilier, and some will say stinkier fish. things like sardines and anchovies and mackerel and those kinds of things. They definitely have a strong flavor, but most of them are fairly small species of fish, and smaller fish tend to be more resistant to overfishing. They grow quicker. They reproduce quicker. They're able to replenish their populations. And the other nice thing about them is that they tend to be less expensive. And a lot of people think that sustainable seafood or organic food or, you know, fair trade, et cetera, that automatically means more expensive. And in a lot of cases, many of the fish on our best choices list are similar in price or less expensive than things on our worst choices list. Canned salmon is another great example.
Let me ask you a question about eating at a sushi restaurant. With all of your knowledge, I'm wondering how you do it, especially if you order like a sushi deluxe platter or something and you're just getting whatever the chef is giving you. How do you take the knowledge that you have and make informed decisions about what you're getting, what you're eating?
Well, it pretty much rules out the possibility of the sushi deluxe platter because at least half of that is going to be farmed salmon, farmed shrimp, longline caught tuna, et cetera. So when I eat out at sushi restaurants, I normally have to go on the a la carte menu and pick out specific items. I like a lot of the shellfish, for example, octopus, squid, clams, oysters. Saba or mackerel is actually another one that I really like a lot, and it's a really good indicator of the quality of the restaurant itself and that it's a fish that, again, is very strong flavor, and so you can tell right away if it's a little bit off or if it hasn't been handled properly. But if you find a restaurant that has good mackerel, that's definitely one to stick with.
Well, Tim Fitzgerald, thanks for being on Fresh Air.
Thanks for having me, Dave.
Tim Fitzgerald, marine scientist for the Environmental Defense Fund. You can download and print one of his Seafood Selector To-Go cards by going to our website, freshair.npr.org. Coming up, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the new CD by the Chris Byers Quartet. This is Fresh Air. Thank you. In February and March of this year, saxophonist Chris Byers led his quartet on a month-long tour sponsored by the U.S. State Department, with stops in Slovenia, Slovakia, and Saudi Arabia. Last year, another band he was in was sent to Central Asia. Back home in New York last October, Chris Byers did a concert at the Rubin Museum, inspired by art from the Himalayas. The music he wrote for that concert is now out on CD. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead has a review.
Chris Byers on alto sax with trombonist John Mosca on Byers' new CD with the ungainly Mussorgskian title, Jazz Pictures at an Exhibition of Himalayan Art. I don't detect more than hints at music from Tibet or Nepal that I've heard, nor catch any parallels between the compositions and the masks and paintings in the album's photo gallery, but this music stands fine on its own. For starters, Byers has written a handful of jumping beboppy tunes. Stefan Schatz on drums with Chris Byers on tenor sax. He also plays a bit of soprano and flute. Byers is a student of overlooked aspects of 1950s and 60s jazz, like the music of tenor player Lucky Thompson. The foursome here sounds informed by the pianoless quartets, pastel harmonies, and woodwind colors of 1950s cool jazz, not least when the leader's dad, James Byers, adds oboe or English horn. Adding oboe gives the band three winds, but it can sound like four when Ari Roland picks up his bow to sing on the bass. He'll often solo using the bow, too. He gets a good jazz sound with it, not too sweet or scrapey. Chris Byers' Jazz Pictures at an Exhibition of Himalayan Art is on Smalls Records, as in the feisty Greenwich Village nightclub Smalls. In the 90s, that basement joint was a second home, finishing school, and research lab for Byers, bassist Ari Roland, and other night owls. The club's partisans talk as if it was the only place in New York where bebop-oriented players could develop their music. An overstatement. But it helped nurture many accomplished players now active in New York. Chris Byers' disc is a good example of the kind of swinging, quirky, finely crafted music that has helped Smalls leave a big mark.
Kevin Whitehead teaches English and American Studies at the University of Kansas, and he's a jazz columnist for eMusic.com. He reviewed Jazz Pictures at an Exhibition of Himalayan Art by the Chris Byers Quartet on Smalls Records. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Sharrock directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bean Cooley.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, presenting daily book reviews, author interviews, and more in the Barnes & Noble Review, online at bn.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, helping to build a more just future for the nation and the world at macfound.org. CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's Loose at 1-877-21-FRESH. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Los Angeles Times columnist Steve Lopez tells us about his encounter 3 years ago with a homeless street musician that led to a life-changing friendship. Lopez sought to understand the mental illness that wrecked a promising music career. The relationship led to a series of columns, a new book, and a movie now in production. Join us for the next Fresh Air.